You are a photo that cannot be torn or cut or crumbled. Pixelized ether cannot be tucked in a box to be remembered fondly when found in warmer weather patterns.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet and bookseller Mara Ponich, whose debut collection, Blood Is Not the Water, is a meditation on the body, its desires, its vulnerabilities, and often its sorrows. Mara Ponich is a writer, artist, and the owner of Fact and Fiction Books in Missoula, Montana. She holds a BA in creative writing and English literature from Purdue University and completed postgraduate studies at the University of Montana. Mara, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks, Lauren. It's good to be here.
This is not the first time you've appeared on The Right Question, but it is the first time you are here to talk about your own work, right? When did you start thinking about publishing your own work in earnest?
In earnest, I started working to get my own work published in late 2017 and early 2018, sending out individual poems to various journals. Started working on getting a book full manuscript published probably 2019.
What did that process look like?
I sent it out to several contests and received some great feedback, was second place in one of the contests. And then following that, I kind of took a break for a little bit. And while I was taking that break is when I was approached by Mark Gibbons about the Montana Poet Series.
And you're one of six, seven poets in that series?
I believe at the moment it's actually five.
Okay.
They may be doing a sixth still.
Okay. What has surprised you most about having a book out in the world? And I should maybe preface this question for listeners. Mara is the owner and operator of Fact and Fiction Books here in Missoula, Montana. And so she's well integrated into the publishing industry. So she's surrounded by books. And so my question, my curiosity about her own surprise about having her own book in the world is based of that. I'm wondering, you know, you have this knowledge of the industry. What knowledge were you missing, you know, now that you are the published author?
I don't know that I was missing any knowledge particular about the publishing industry. What came back was I was surprised that so many people responded to the book, but that's less the publishing industry and more people in my life and people in the world around me that are either familiar with me or not that have been purchasing the book. I guess with my unique position is I get to see who's buying my book. Unlike a lot of authors, they never see all the names of the orders that come through. And people that I haven't seen in 25 years were ordering my book. Friends from high school and my babysitter from when I was like 7 years old. And that was kind of an amazing feeling, that getting to see that these people still care, even though we haven't been in connection directly for years and years and years. It's reassuring to know that people don't just forget.
You say you're a sentimental person. What does that look like? What does that mean for you?
Everything holds meaning, big or small. There's just importance to everything, to every little thing, to the from the cup of coffee you get in the morning, to the gift you get from a friend, to having my grandmother's mother's ring. Those are all important things in the world. And maybe the cup of coffee in the morning is only important for a short time, but as a sentimental person, you really relish those things. Or the moment you get to see someone, you really relish those things.
So Mara, let's give listeners a window into this collection. I'm hoping you will be willing to read the title poem, Blood Is Not the Water.
Sure. Blood is not the water. Blood is not the water our children are restless about, but wine in bladders and ice-cubed coffee mugs. Last night, I dreamt I was dancing with a bear, leash in hand, twirling, twirling, twirling. Awoke, swimming with sweat, a beastly odor lingering in my nose. When I placed my finger in your mouth, it was a test of trust, a temptation to bite or suckle, and your bare mouth behaved, as expected, both tender and teeth, to spill wine on my chest.
I want to linger on the word temptation. Temptation, desire, the space between your first-person speakers in these poems and then the bodies of others. I feel like it's all very energetic and buzzing. And this collection is very much about the body, your body, or the speaker's bodies, right? What is your current relationship to your body, and how did it change through the writing of those poems, if it did?
I have gone through a long process of attempting and sometimes succeeding, sometimes failing at loving myself and loving my body, as many women and men, but women in particular, tend to struggle with feeling beautiful, feeling desirable. Also, on the flip side of that, with many women, it's hard to express desire, because also we are held back from expressing desire. So I've spent a lot of time trying to come to a place where my body is mine, and it's a thing I can love, and it's a thing that I can feel is worthy of my own love, as well as other people's love and desire. And then as a woman also, the idea of being able to put that desire out into the world, be it for another body or food or clothes or makeup or books or whatever, being able to want is a sometimes taboo thing for women. I think to consider oneself desirable can be looked upon as a like conceited or self-centered attitude. And I think in general, we tend to think of being desired as something that only comes from without. And if we accept that people from outside are desiring us, that it's somehow bad that we accept that and we even relish in it. And maybe, I wouldn't have thought of it before, but maybe that's the masking that you're referring to, is that if I talked about others' desire for self, for myself, in the same way that I talk about my own love for self, it could be very much so considered a conceited, or she thinks so highly of herself, or
which is just another way of saying that, like, that's something we're not really taught how to do, or that it's not something that's so public, like how to love oneself.
Right. And how to accept. I think we're getting better at telling people how to love themselves and to love themselves with self-care and body positivity. But I don't think it quite touches on the idea of, yes, it's okay for you to know that other people also think highly of you, and for to relish in that. Like, you got to love yourself, but you got to let other people love you too. And I've spent a lot of time working on that, and a lot of the poems in this book express that feeling of want.
Would you say that writing these poems helped you through any of that process, or did these poems come after that comfort had already been attained?
I think they definitely helped. Writing is a way of organizing thoughts, and the poems definitely helped me solidify those ideas, even though I was working on them elsewhere and in other facets.
And I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit, because another thread or threads that are kind of sewn throughout this collection are ideas of sorrow and grief and mourning, which maybe on their face seem in opposition to the ideas of desire and want and temptation and lust that are very present in the collection. But what do you see as the connection between these things? Temptation, desire, grief, sorrow, mourning. Do you feel like there is a connection? And if so, how do you feel like your collection brings that connection out?
I think there's two answers to that question. The first being specific to these poems in this book, because my mother passed away several years ago now, and many of the poems deal with that grief. So as I was writing, I was dealing with that grief and all the other things that are in there. So there's a specific instance of grief and trauma that arises throughout. But I also do think that all strong emotions are interconnected, or at least they're not very far away from one another. We often see depictions of people doing wild things after a funeral or when somebody dies. And that feeling of exhilaration, I think, is connected to the feeling of grief. I just don't think most of our emotions are as far apart as we like to think they are.
No, I think you're right. There's an Eileen Miles quote, and I don't know if it was a quote that they wrote down. I think it might have been a quote that I heard them say in person, but they were talking about how people want to have sex after funerals. And that sentiment is sort of echoed in what you were saying. If you don't mind me asking, you said your mother passed away several years ago. How long have you been processing the death of your mother through poetry?
Since before she died, she was sick for a long time, and grief arises in the weirdest, strangest places when you just don't expect it. And while she was sick, I was writing through it. This is not to say that all of them are sad, tragic things, but yeah, I don't think any of the poems were particularly a surprise of grief. But sometimes when writing original drafts just in my journal, it would surprise me when things would come up. You know, if you've lost somebody and you're cooking something and the scent brings back this brick wall of a memory that seems out of nowhere, you weren't even thinking about them, but all of a sudden you're awash with it. And as writing, when I'm doing most of my writing, I'm just following whatever's coming. And it's surprising sometimes what comes.
Would you say in that sense then, when you're writing, you said you're following whatever is coming, whatever you're feeling in the moment. Do you sit down to write about a specific thing and then whatever you're feeling towards that specific thing is what you write? Or are you writing and perhaps doing a stream of consciousness thing? I'm wondering more about your process then.
I do both. Much of the time, when I'm sitting down to write about a specific thing, it's often because I had some kind of spark of an idea. And that happens whenever it likes to happen. So sometimes that's recording my voice on my phone or typing it in the notes on my phone because I don't have a piece of paper handy or my journal. Sometimes I can sit down and write it. And usually that goes the way I expect it to, but sometimes it also takes turns. And then I do try my best to write every day. And a lot of the times that's either prompted, I'll use a prompt guide, or it's more just stream of consciousness and going with whatever starts to come out of my pen. Sometimes it's, I don't know what I want to write about, but I have to write for 10 minutes.
Do you feel closer to your mother through your poetry about her?
I was pretty close to my mom, but we had a lot of issues. Nothing horrible, what I would consider pretty typical, actually, mother-daughter issues. I don't know that I feel closer to her through writing the poems, but I think I've come to a better comfort level with the things we went through and with the issues we shared. My mother was fairly young when she passed. She was only 67 years old. And I'm now becoming the age I see my mother as in my head. Because I think we all kind of put, like, especially when we don't have them anymore, there's like a certain.
They become kind of like solidified in time as that person.
Right. Or as the person Like when I think about her, I think of her in her 40s. That's where most of our interaction was as mother and daughter. And I think through both that, just coming to this age, and through working through a lot of the personal issues that were also connected to her, some of which she shared, some of which she shared and then also gave to me, and working through those, I wouldn't say it makes me closer to her, but it makes me more comfortable.
And it sounds like you might have a little bit more compassion for her.
Yeah. Yeah. That's more compassion and empathy for what she was experiencing.
The poetic voice that I found most fascinating in these poems, and it's present throughout, to be honest, is so confident. It's so certain of itself. Do these poems share your voice, Mara Ponich's voice, your confidence, or do you find that you're able to express yourself in poetry in ways that you can't in person?
I think these poems capture me, my voice at my best, at my most confident. There are times when I am that person out in public and in the world, but I wouldn't say that voice is my all the time confidence. I do consider myself a pretty confident person, and that loops back to working on all the different ways to be confident. But there's certainly a lot of insecurity that shows in the real world and shows in my personal life.
I hope that you'll be willing to read another poem.
Sure.
Perhaps one of what I have called like a sorrow poem, but like, you know, specifically like I loved Morning Ceremony, but I would love it if you chose whichever poem you'd like to read. Give it
a
whirl.
Try.
Let's give it a try.
We'll see. It's one I've just never chosen to read out loud because, like I said. Morning Ceremony. On gray mornings, the sun struggles to break the sky. Development is delayed. Setting balance of white on white encourages tenacity in a projected image. Desire closing. Shutter slowly. With less speed and more consideration. Body clicks and shifts towards gentle lighting, overexposed, reaching for soft illumination like leaves edging, stop motion to photosynthesis. A digitized image, in my memory, you are a photo that cannot be torn or cut or crumbled. Pixelized ether cannot be tucked in a box to be remembered fondly when found in warmer weather patterns. Deletion after desertion, a quick selection, wiped clean, suffer the deprivation of ritual, burning, tearing, tossing away. The delirious detritus of a snapshot.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with poet Mara Ponich. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Your book is a part of what is called the Montana series,
yes.
A Montana poet series. You are living in Montana. Is this a Montana book? Like, is this distinctly Montana?
Distinctly Montana? I don't know, but it is a Montana book. It was all written in while living in and experiences of here. I think a lot of people think of Montana and what would be called Montana books or Montana poetry as just being nature and mountains and fish and things like that. And that's the beauty of this series, is there is a vast variety of types of poems, which in my head reflects better our state than just focusing on the one facet of what it is to be a Montanan, to live in Montana, to be a writer in Montana. And there are birds and mountains in the book too.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about your birds and mountains, Mara. One of the reasons why that question, I wanted to pose that question to you in the first place is because there are a number of poems that kind of speak to that tradition. And I'm thinking of titles like Trough or Drought or Poverty Line or Trapping on Private Land. They're all really interesting titles because on their face, they do fall into this Western tradition. But yet they actually, at least in my reading, serve as metaphors, right, for what I'll call confessional poetry. Yeah, what is the impulse titling a poem Trapping on Private Land and that poem being of the body and not the body of the land, really?
Perhaps it is because I live in Montana, but these are things that are, trapping on private land is something that's, or just trapping in general is something that's around and comes up and is in the news, and those metaphors are going to leak in because it is, like I said, it is Montana poetry, because I live here in Montana, and that's where I'm going to get my words. They're all gathered here, so I'm not going to find a lot of, mangoes.
I want to know how you came to Montana.
I grew up in Indiana. I went to Purdue University in my, just across the river from my hometown. And I graduated with a degree in English Lit and Creative Writing. When I decided to go to graduate school, I only applied to schools west of the Mississippi and in mountainous regions, because that's where I wanted to be. I don't know what it is that drew me, but I've always loved being in mountain towns. And so when U of M accepted me and I came out here and visited, I really loved this town. I knew nobody here except for the one person I knew that lived here actually moved away a month before I moved here. I struggled really hard when I moved here. And I think a big part of that is coming from someplace where I had been all my life. Mm-hmm. So I had very solid friendships. I had a lot of family. And then being here was exceptionally isolating. And probably the first 3 to 6 months, I wasn't sure if I was going to make it even through school, let alone now it's been 19 years.
Oh, wow.
But partially, yes, I agree. Missoula can be tough, but I think that's tough for anybody moving anywhere that they don't already have a built-in community.
How did you get into reading poetry? Have you always read poetry? Have you always wanted to write poetry? Or is that coming later on?
I have always wanted to write poetry. I think since I won a city poetry contest when I was maybe 8 or 10, I still remember, "In the future, we will go far. In the future, we will live on a star," if that tells you anything. So I've always written poetry, got really into it in high school, and then pursued it in college. I was a part of a writer's group in late high school and early college called the Granville Poets, where we all got together and workshopped together. Yeah, did open mics at coffee shops when I was in high school and college, and at like city events, things like that, and just continued. I stopped writing for a while, but never truly stopped. It would be, I'd still scratch a line down here and there.
Has being a bookseller changed the way you read poetry, or even the way you perceive poetry kind of in the larger publishing community or industry?
It has. As a bookseller, I work really hard to promote poetry. We're lucky here in Missoula to have such a fantastic MFA program, which has created a community that loves poetry. But in the bookselling world, poetry is a very little child of that has to be cared for by certain people. And with that point of view in mind, I know how much it means to poets when I find a book I love and I actually work to sell it mm-hmm. to people.
What is one thing listeners may not know, but might be surprised to learn about bookselling, about writing, or again, speaking to the publishing industry kind of at large?
Bookselling, as you know, as a former bookseller, is a lot more than just sitting around reading and selling books, particularly as an owner, but also just as a bookseller. There's a lot that goes into it. And a lot of people, oh, I've always dreamed of owning a little bookshop and sitting around and reading all day. And that is not what owning a bookshop is, nor working at a bookshop. It's a lot of work as a retailer, but it's also a lot of fun. It's great work. And I feel like the same thing is with being a writer. And I think writers get a similar comment of, I've always wanted to write. I've always wanted to be a poet or thought I could. And people don't realize that, well, maybe they do because they don't actually do it. They just say, I've always wanted to. But it is a lot of work. It's not this dreamy sitting at a typewriter in front of a window by the bay. Just sudden flash of inspiration. Now I've written
The Great American Novel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, publishing is also like getting published, small presses, both the press and the writer and the booksellers all have to do a lot to promote and get those books and those words into your hands.
Mara, you've dedicated this collection to your mother, your grandmothers, and all the people who taught you that there are many ways to be a strong woman. Mara, what else gives you strength?
First of all of those people have given me strength. And I suppose just community and friendship and being a person in the world and seeing caring. I'm a kind of sentimental person. And community, friends, family, and the larger world.
How do you feel about the collection now that it's like out in the world? Like, do you feel distant from it? I mean, obviously we've been talking to it, so maybe you feel close to it in moments like this, but have you moved on? Are you on to other writing at this point, or are you still steeping in this collection?
I think for a while I was steeping in it. Right after it came out, I wasn't writing much. I wasn't feeling like writing much. I have hit recently a spurt of writing a lot. And I think I'm finally feeling that break from, okay, I published a book, to, okay, maybe we need enough poems that are good enough to maybe try again the next time. You know, I'm still really close to a lot of the things in this book. Like we said, with grief and different emotions, they come up and they re-arise. But at the same time, it's now time to move forward and write new.
Mara, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lauren.
You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Austin. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.